The Pacers are going to the finals. It is everybody's dream matchup if you love big NBA matchups in the Pacers in Oklahoma City.
Big market matchup.
Oh, yeah, man. We hadn't seen one like this in a minute.
We've never seen anything like this. That's for sure.
That is fair. And to join us and talk about it, it is our friend and guest. He is on the Circa Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circa app today. Jamal Collier. Also, congratulations on everything in life. It is good to talk to you. He's a reporter for ESPN, as you know.
Good to talk to you guys. How we doing?
You know, we're making it, man. We're wondering what this attendance is going to be like in terms of television viewership, because I was going back through some finals matchups of the past. I was like, this might be the worst ever in the, I guess, ABC era in terms of who's watching, because they don't know these players necessarily. Although I feel like Tyrese Halliburton has made a name for himself. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he is the MVP. But for some reason, I'm scared that people aren't going to watch like they should be. Jamal, are you concerned?
I'm gonna be watching, and
you get paid to watch.
It's gonna be listen. This is gonna be the ball knowers series, man. Like, these teams are both been playing super well, been playing very good. I think it's an intriguing matchup when you look at Indiana's offense and how good that unit's been. The Thunder defense, how good that unit's been all playoffs, and seeing them finally clash on the stage, I think will be fun. And really, these two fan bases, I think, are two of the best in the NBA as well. Like, OKC, their atmosphere has been really charged all playoffs. The Pacers and Indy, obviously, is like basketball is so core to that state. I think you're going to have a really good atmospheres in the games. You're going to have the crowds and the cities are going to be super into it. And look, I think this has been like a sea change playoffs and a sea change season for the league, where we've seen really the old guard. You know, it's been coming for a few years, but I think it's really, really kind of come and hit home this year that the two mid-2000s, 2010s players really that we kind of have been used to being on this stage are just not the best players in the league anymore. And these guys, these younger sort of generation of players are here, and these are two of the best sort of representations of it with SGA and Halliburton.
Jamal, I think you hit on a lot of really valid points. Not only is this the ball knower series, I feel like that's a great compliment to those who will appreciate it, but also in the change level of what we're seeing, this might also be the best example already as to the effects of the CBA on teams being successful. How the rosters have been built, how the trade deadline wasn't nearly as wild as it typically was, outstanding of the Luka Doncic trade, of course. There's a lot to the result of this being something that really may have been dictated by the legislation that was put in place off the court.
I think Miles Turner said this after the Pacers wrapped up, that he called these teams sort of the blueprint going forward. And, you know, the era of get three stars, fill the rest out with minimums, you know, that's gone. I think teams have recognized that for a few years, and really the effects of this last of the CBA have started to hit home, you know, really hard this year. And both these teams have that same idea of, you know, they've really got one or two guys at the top that are star or star level, but really haven't maybe hit the really stars, you know, the supermax money of it all. But money aside of it, it's just you have some guys, you have a team that makes sense. You have depth. You have, you know, a bench. You're playing both these teams play like 8, 9, even 10 at sometimes, you know, rosters. And obviously the guys at the top, Halliburton and SGA, make everything go. And you need that still superstar top 10 player to get to this point. You could debate on the sort of semantics on Halliburton, but he's played like that during the playoffs. I think that is the model you're going to see teams really start to shift toward and start to build toward. And as opposed to, you know, obviously what Phoenix has done, that sort of really went up in flames as putting a sort of more top heavy roster. I think that is the effect of the CBA as well, is that you'll see you know, Arturis got some shade for it at the trade deadline. And I think he sort of misstated the point, but the idea behind having a 8, 9, 10 man rotation and building with depth, is how teams are looking. Like, you still need the superstar at the top, and that's the big key with these two teams. You still need somebody to sort of hand the ball to at the end of the game. But yeah, man, these both have really 8 or 9 guys that they all are going to feel good about playing.
Well, the interesting thing about what you're saying, and yes, I know it's true. Miles Turner was right. You're right. We all understand what's happening. But I'm wondering how much of this is a function of, hey, the highest paid players on our team, Tyrese Haliburton and Pascal Siakam, are making $42 million a year. The highest paid player on the team for the Thunder is only making $35 million a year, and that's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They're going to be due, well, at least Alexander is, like some serious raises here. And I'm wondering how can they keep this together based on the fact that what you just said about not having two to three guys getting paid a whole lot of money. I mean, this also, in the context of Dallas and moving Luka Doncic, makes sense to me.
I'm not going to agree with that last part, but until then, I was following you.
I'm just going to let you two marinate.
No, like $75 million for Doncic,
But the idea of allocating, teams want to break those up into multiple salaries. You need depth. You need, and paying the way the CBA is set up, the way the salaries are set up, paying one player and really a couple of players, your entire cap doesn't make any sense anymore. The Thunder are going to have some hard decisions to make, I think, over the next couple of years. They are set up to make all those decisions because of the youth of their team, because of the draft picks, because of all the blah, blah, blah. But they've got a chance to really have a dynastic run. You know, if they could, obviously are heavy favorites right now, and they've got the experience now that you're going to stack on top of it. I think those are good problems that they'll be happy to answer in the next couple of years. Because they've really built a strong team, and the Pacers as well have built strong teams that, you know, you get a Pascal Siakam who was undervalued. And when they made that trade last trade deadline, I think we all kind of said, okay, you know, it's a nice trade. But the way he's really just been a game changer for them and for the entire conference is something that you, I don't think any of us really saw coming. So there's something to it. These teams have sort of caught a good break in where their salaries are, but it's been because of smart team building as well to put themselves in this situation.
You know who else was kind of shrugging their shoulders about Pascal Siakam's impact on this team? I think it was Tyrese Haliburton, because tell me if I'm wrong, Jamal, but Tyrese Haliburton thought he was winning the Eastern Conference Finals MVP, and there's video evidence of this all over the internet. And then Pascal Siakam's name gets mentioned, announced as the guy who actually won the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. I believe that's the Larry Bird Award. And he had to take a step back, Tyrese Haliburton. Is that an embarrassing moment for a guy who's had a pretty good playoff run to this point?
Look, I mean, I had a vote. I voted for Tyrese. I thought he should have won it, and I was also mildly surprised. It was tough. I don't think I debated between Pascal and Tyrese for pretty much the entire second half into fourth quarter and even the day before that.
What was the deciding factor for you?
Tyrese makes everything go. I mean, he's their best player. He's their engine. And even, you know, when you add up the game four, which was obviously brilliant, it was the fancy stats game, 30 of 15, you know, he had the game winner, or the clutch shot, I should say, in game one. And you have in game six, all the fast break points is sort of Tyrese's the engine. If he's not getting assists for all that, the reason they got out and run is his hit ahead. I just thought he had enough of, when you are the best player, you have those sort of definitive moments and samples. That just kind of put the edge over for me, even though I thought Siakam was their most consistent player. You know, Haliburton, for better or worse, puts himself out there, and he has moments like this where he likes to talk trash and be the face and be showy, and then, you know, has to sometimes wear it. I don't know. He's still in the finals. I don't think he's going to be that broken up about it, especially for a trophy they've just made up in the last like 2 years.
I mean, valid trophy though. They needed to expand just based on the talent in the NBA. I think one of the bigger points though, Jamal, too, in all of this is that we used to know what the formula was. We used to know that the formula was build a super team. Somewhere after the Spurs dynasty subsided, then came the Heat run, and then what we saw happen in Golden State. So you knew you either had to combine superstars or be the most offensively efficient team of all time. And then everybody started copying those models. And now this shows you it's changed again. And we were watching. We were watching what Sam Presti was doing in Oklahoma City. Yeah, we knew that the Pacers had acquired a lot of talent. The team in and of itself, you would see individual performances for the last 2 years where you're saying, oh, this guy had a really good game. This guy's really good. You know, you're saying that to yourself. But now we don't know exactly what the formula is in all of this moving forward.
Yeah, I'm still processing this Pacers run in general. And I've been around for all of it, really last year and this year, especially this whole run this year. But the fact that they are here in the finals, it's still odd, to be honest. Like, they don't profile as the typical finals team. And I was even entering the playoffs. I mean, I've been repeating this stat a lot, but since January 1st, they were 34-14. You know, they had a profile that looked like every other, you know, they were the fourth best team in the NBA. So OKC, Boston, Cleveland had sort of the gaudier win totals, but Indiana was right there with them. And I thought that they were sort of a sleeper in that sense coming in, but still never could have expected or predicted the run that they went on. And, you know, is it an anomaly? Is it predictive? I think a lot of teams, if you're in the East, I think you can feel good about this being a model, because the conference has gotten worse. It's gotten more wide open because of injuries, because of a few other things. But I kind of just go back to that first point of, I think because of the rules and because of the way teams are looking at the offense in the game, the Pacers have been playing in, the way they've been able to disrupt team with that. Teams are just looking at the fact that we want to build a deeper roster than you had to before and be more versatile in a lot of different ways. That's one thing the Pacers, I'm sort of focusing on them, the Thunder have this as well, where, yes, they have the Halliburton and three-point shooting, but they also have that sort of Siakam piece of their team that when things are down and they need a bucket, he can create for them. He can do things for them. The Thunder have that in a bunch of different ways as well. It's SGA, it's the turnovers. Jalen Williams and Chet have really stepped up in the Western Conference Finals. I do think this has been, a change season in general as far as the faces of the league, of what you think winning looks like and what a winning team feels like. And I think just the Pacers are just the biggest, it just feels like an anomaly, even though they've absolutely earned the way, you know, the run that they've had to get here.
Joined by Jamal Collier here on Rahimi and Harris, the NBA reporter for ESPN, talking everything playoffs, also the Bulls and how they're looking at this through their lens. But Jamal, this seems like a wasted opportunity for the New York Knicks, and I'm wondering if they're going to do something drastic because of the way this ended, the fact that they were able to get by the Celtics, the defending champs, and able to really make something happen, only to lose here in this series against a Pacers team that seemed to have an answer and just out-physicaled them throughout the way this went. Will they do something drastic, or will they just simply look back at game one and say, if we don't lose that game, we probably have a way better chance of winning the series?
Yeah, all the Knicks talk has been pretty interesting to me in the aftermath, because it feels like it is a missed opportunity, first of all, for them, and they should look at it. But I also, it feels like that everybody, you know, thinks of them as there was some big gap. And the Pacers, I thought, were clearly the better team by the end of the series. But, you know, the Pacers have done so, they did three rounds in a row, had this big comeback. But, man, if you're in New York, it's just like there should be a game seven today. You just don't blow a 15-point lead in game one. I just think everything looks a lot different. So I'll be curious of where they land. I don't have any intel on what their exact thinking is. And I think that the Jalen and Kat, you know, playing together of that all, I think that's an interesting question to pose. But if I'm them, I think taking a step back, realizing that this was the most successful season they've had in a long time. They did a lot of good things. They took a lot of big step forwards, and probably just trying to find some depth, trying to find a way to enter the year with a real rotation. I was struck, and they ended up winning game five, but I remember just sitting and watching one of the lineups. They had like Landry Shamet, DeLon Wright, Josh Hart. It must've been Towns was the only star, quote unquote, on the floor. And I just was like, this is not how they've gotten here. You know, it was just like, this is it. The Pacers have got them completely out of sorts. And those guys obviously played some big minutes and played a role, but the Pacers just had them playing in a completely, they lost their identity. The Knicks were playing in a whole different way. And just sort of, I think having an answer to what our identity is, what does our best team and best lineups look like? I would you know, maybe not run it back completely. I think there's some, like I said, some things on the margins they can do, but I would not overreact that drastically if I'm the Knicks, especially considering the state of the conference next year with Boston potentially taking a step back. You don't know what Milwaukee will look like. The rest of the conference is not that good.
Jamal Collar. Fair enough. That was a bullet at the end of that statement.
Give it a hand, you know.
Jamal, nice writing on the fly speaking. That I could see you ending a story for ESPN in that manner. Jamal, thank you so much for joining us. And really, just an in-depth look, I think, at the future of the NBA in a really great way. Thanks for coming on.
Love having you guys. Love hearing his Rahimi and Harris title guys. So bring it back on, you know, let's do it again.
Thrilled to bring you back on. Jamal.